Truth Espresso, Episode 11.
Face it, we all would rather sleep in this morning. That's why God gave us espresso, to kickstart our zombified corpses into hyperdrive. And now, giving your mind and soul the morning shot of truth it craves. This is Truth Espresso with Daniel Minnick.
Hello, this is Daniel Minnick, your host for Truth Espresso. Welcome back. If you've been listening up until episode 11, then I will have to say welcome back. And if you have listened to the episodes prior to this one, if you're not just getting started in episode 11, you would realize that we have definitely gone out the door covering topics that do not shy away from controversy, although I have attempted to present them in a gentlemanly way, as I have explained that I would try to do in the introductory episode, episode zero. But this episode kind of embraces a controversial topic that has a lot of supply of controversy, as we might say. It is a very hot button issue. It is one of those taboo topics, and that is the issue of abortion. And this episode, I am entitling Abortion Fiction. Now, I believe that this will become a series of episodes because I am responding to a particular article. In fact, I was working on notes for an episode related to the topic of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and the promises and the consequences of that. And I had not even finished working on the notes for an episode about Obamacare when my wife sent me a link to an article written for the New York Times. And I read this article, and although I was not surprised, I realized that this article was going to have to be addressed first. It is actually a pretty recent article. It was published on the New York Times June 23rd, 2019. So, what happens when a screenwriter slash novelist writes a politically lopsided opinion piece about abortion for the New York Times? You end up with an opinion piece with no citations, makes unfounded accusations, commits many logical fallacies, begs the question, and completely ignores anything remotely related to answering the actual questions relevant to the controversy itself of abortion. In other words, what do I have to say about this article? It's a modern work of genius. This article is entitled The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade. This was written by John Irving, who is a novelist and a screenwriter, as I mentioned. So, in brief summary of this article, here's what the article has to say. This is my summary and my paraphrase. So first of all, anti-abortionists are irrationally mean and insensitive to women and to children outside the womb. Abortion in the first half of pregnancy was actually a common good during the colonial period. But for some unknown reason, lots of evil doctors managed to get abortion illegal in all 50 states one by one in the mid to late 1800s. Even though an obvious societal need screamed for the abortion services that they as doctors could have provided for profit. Society needs to care for the downtrodden, like pregnant women who need abortions. And I wrote, I'm speaking of Mr. John Irving here, I wrote a novel that was very historically accurate and depicted an adopted person who grew up to become a loving doctor. But he had to come to grips with the reality against his intuition that abortion services are actually a good thing for women. And I won the prestigious Margaret Sanger Award for this novel that turned into a film. And it wasn't until the moral majority led by Jerry Falwell and company in the late 1900s that this whole nonsense of quote-unquote pro-life began, and pro-life is nothing but a marketing term. But I do respect, you know, you pro-lifers, I do respect your pro-life views, really I do, but you just need to respect mine. So, as I get into this article, it is not an attempt, as I have read it and understood it, this article is not an attempt to persuade committed pro-life advocates through really good arguments for the pro-abortion position. It is not an attempt to persuade pro-lifers to Mr. Irving's position. It is merely preaching to the leftist choir the talking points that they love to hear while plugging their ears and saying la 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 at any relevant question to the terms of the whole debate. So, this article begins by making this bold statement, quote, "Abortion opponents don't care what happens to an unwanted child, and they've never cared about the mother." So, that sounds like a very broad-brushing statement. I mean, Mr. Irving could have been a little more statistically accurate, perhaps. He could have said, some, or many, or most. Nope. According to Mr. Irving, if you hold a pro-life position, by definition, if you oppose abortion in any way, you fall under this subhuman accusation. You don't care about women and you don't care about children outside the womb. You just have this strange attachment to fetuses inside the womb that are developing, but once they come outside the womb, then they can be killed or abandoned or whatever. So that's what so-called pro-lifers believe. That's the first statement of the article. So pro-lifers, do you embrace that with abandon? Probably not. But don't worry, this article will explain later on how pro-lifers fit this less than amicable description, and of course, Mr. Irvin will just assume the truth of his reasoning without asking and answering the questions that his assumptions raise. Particularly, as a spoiler, his assumptions have to do with the idea that if you don't support, you know, socialized healthcare and welfare, you know, government welfare programs, if you just simply don't support those, by definition, you're not caring for mothers and their children. So, let's move on to the next statement in which Mr. Irving begins to attempt to explain this statement, because he will repeat it at the end of the article. Quote, "Amid the anti-abortion measures being pushed through state legislatures, consider the mazy history of abortion in the United States." So, of course, this statement talking about anti-abortion measures being pushed through state legislatures comes on the heels of the recent pro-infanticide state bills and court rulings. But none of that matters or causes Mr. Irving to bat an eye. The only matter of concern is the fact that there are anti-abortion measures being pushed through state legislatures. What would Mr. Irving have to say about legalized infanticide in these cases after birth? Surely life begins at least at birth, right? How about the next day? So where is that line according to Mr. John Irving? Well, the question of that line is conveniently left out of the article. Mr. Irving never even addresses that. The issue of when life does begin and is the fetus a full human being is never addressed. Why shouldn't it be? Isn't that why there's even a debate? No, Mr. Irving simply assumes the truthfulness of his position without supporting it any way. Why? Because he's a novelist. That makes him an authority on the topic. So, moving on, let's go to the next sentence. Quote, women capable of determining and managing their reproductive rights have been undermined by men in power before. Now, here is the crux of Mr. Irving's proof. Women being oppressed by, quote, unquote, men in power. It doesn't even address, this article does not even address the issue of what is the unborn. Is a human life innocent of any capital crime to society being snuffed against its will because it has no choice about being conceived in the womb and cannot even voice its opinion, and is there potentially any pain or destruction of actual life? No, it's all about men in power. For some odd reason, men just gravitate toward a fetus fetish for the sole purpose of controlling women. The question of what is the unborn never crosses the minds of these men or Mr. Irving, or if it does cross their minds, it is only an excuse to control women for the mere unexplainable purpose of controlling them. For some unknown reason, many men just want to deny women reproductive rights because it's something that they allegedly enjoy, but they don't want women to enjoy. Now, you'd think men would like their wives to love them a little bit more if that's all it was about, was just giving them their rights. But for some reason, men just like to control women when they get power, and we need to deprive them of that power so that they can no longer control women for inexplicable reasons. Now, as an aside, or not really an aside, but as of note, my wife is a CNM, that's a certified nurse midwife. She got her postmaster's degree in certified nurse midwifery from an accredited secular state university. She has delivered over 100 babies, so I think she knows a little bit about women's health here and what a baby is, what a fetus is, and the delivery process. And she is 100% pro-life. She believes that life begins at conception. She believes that human life begins at conception and deserves protection and not to be killed. And I have nothing to do with her belief here. I never imposed that on her. Perhaps she was brainwashed by someone. If she was, she seems to have been brainwashed by other women, and, well, maybe perhaps these women were brainwashed. Well, who knows, but all I know is that my wife is 100% pro-life, and she can make a good case for that. So now let's consider, for Mr. Irving's consideration in this concept of women being suppressed by men in power, let us consider crisis pregnancy centers. Oh yes, Planned Parenthood loves to bash crisis pregnancy centers. They're not really real medical places. Now, you know, there can be some crisis pregnancy centers that might operate without the most stringent standards and requirements. But so let's ask the question, are crisis pregnancy centers that try to dissuade women away from abortions, are these the result of quote unquote men in power? If you think crisis pregnancy centers are established by men, funded primarily by men, and staffed by men, you really would need to have your eyes examined just a little bit. Crisis pregnancy centers are definitely the product of women, pro-life women, largely, and I have been in crisis pregnancy centers as my wife has gone for ultrasounds and volunteered to help, and, you know, everyone there's a woman. Now, let's consider this claim from Mr. Irving about men in power, and read the very next statements in light of this. So, quote, prior to the 1840s, abortion was widespread and not illegal in our country. In the time of the Puritans, America's deeply religious founding fathers, abortion was allowed until the fetus was quick, quote-unquote quick, as they called it. That's my editorial there. Abortion was allowed until the fetus was quick, when the woman could feel the fetus move. So that's quite the claim about history there, with no citation to back it up. But let's see this allegedly abortion-friendly colonial period through the lens of the claim that the issue has always been about the struggle for so-called reproductive rights against so-called men in power. What do we know about the colonial culture that Mr. Irving admittedly terms Puritan? So, who occupied government at all levels during that time? Men? Who owned all businesses that were not related to things like embroidery, interior decorating, midwifery, or any other traditionally female interests? Men? Who held all clergy positions in churches? Men? Well, it seems like Puritan colonial America would be the epitome of a society that is entirely, quote-unquote, men in power. Yet, according to Mr. Irving, this deeply religious, as he calls it, and apparently male-dominated culture was allegedly friendly toward abortions. But opponents of abortion are all about men in power. Men in power are the big problem, but so today, when there are more women in places of power than in the colonial period, men allegedly oppose abortion even more. Does that make any sense? Yet, given our historical precedent, what we have here in the colonial period, given the historical precedent, if men ever dominate the culture like they once did during the colonial period, they would naturally become friendlier toward abortions? Mr. Irving, how does this reasoning even begin to make sense? How are your statements consistent with each other? Are we... We are barely into the article, and there is much more to cover and more inconsistencies to uncover. So let's move on to the next statement. Quote, before modern diagnostic ultrasound, abortion was permissible beyond the first trimester, up to 4 or 5 months. Our founding fathers got this right. The choice to have an abortion or a child belonged to the woman, unquote. So, let's take this line, let's compare this with the statements that were made right before. Once again, the men in power, founding fathers, allegedly accepted abortions, according to Mr. Irving. Beats me how Mr. Irving is trying to make an argument. But notice that first statement. Before modern diagnostic ultrasound, abortion was permissible beyond the first trimester, up to 4 or 5 months. Does Mr. Irving draw any conclusion between why the colonialists were allegedly more friendly to abortion and why things allegedly changed since, quote-unquote, modern diagnostic ultrasound became available? Nope. Does Mr. Irving's own conjoined statements beg that question? How could they not? Yet ultrasound seems to play no role in this debate for Mr. Irving. It's simply incidental. It tells us nothing. It's mere chronology and mysteriously nothing else. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great Oz has spoken. So let's see. Mr. Irving admits that ultrasound technology is, quote, diagnostic. That's his word, not mine. Is it perhaps diagnostic enough to identify what exactly is in the womb, enough to, you know, give us more information than the Puritan quickening could tell us? That Mr. Irving seems to be attached to that quickening concept of the Puritans. No, of course not. Could it influence whether we know that a living human being with a beating heart is present at only 5 weeks? Not a chance. It's irrelevant. Ultrasound is merely a diagnostic tool for genetic anomalies. And, of course, it's also a modern means by which men in power lord over women for no other apparent reason than to lord over women. I am, of course, being sarcastic, but how is that unlike the hidden conclusion Mr. Irving expects us to see with these statements that demand no causal connection? Ultrasound is modern and diagnostic, and before that, abortions were okay, at least in Mr. Irving's understanding of history, but he draws no conclusion between the two. Consider what Mr. Irving wants us to believe about our allegedly abortion-friendly, yet ironically men-in-power ancestors. He claims that they got this right because of their view of quickening when the mother feels the baby kick. In other words, they were right precisely because they were ignorant. This is exactly what Mr. Irving is suggesting. After all, ultrasound is diagnostic in a way that quickening could not be. But why would ignorance make one right? Well, according to Mr. Irving, what is right is that, quote, the choice to have an abortion or a child belong to the woman, unquote. But why is that right, Mr. Irving? Do you have a basis for that? Why would ignorance make one right? Doesn't modern science demonstrate that bloodletting is not right because we now know more about how the human body works? And shouldn't modern diagnostic ultrasound, as Mr. Irving calls it, wouldn't modern diagnostic ultrasound help us to figure out what is right about the issue of abortion? Mr. Irving clearly wants to have his cake and eat it too. On one hand, he would criticize the ignorance of deeply religious colonial Americans for their quaint ideas of God, creation, morality, and society against the so-called scientific evidence that is available today, right? Yet he also wants to reward the colonialists with being right on supporting early abortions, precisely because they were ignorant of the information that scientific advancements give us through modern diagnostic ultrasound. Please be consistent, Mr. Irving. After all this, we haven't yet begun to put Mr. Irving's history lesson to the test of scrutiny. I have merely given him the benefit of the doubt, because if Mr. Irving's version of history is true, his whole argument collapses. Yet, apparently also, if he is wrong about history and history is more pro-life, then his whole argument collapses once again. So Mr. Irving's stuck in a quandary. He has no way to defend his reasoning. If history was friendly to abortions, then Doesn't modern diagnostic ultrasound show that maybe they were wrong? But if history was more pro-life and Mr. Irving is wrong about history, then his arguments still don't work. And of course, I would like to mention once again, none of this article, there is not once in this whole article where Mr. Irving even attempts or begins to try to address arguments for the so-called pro-life position, as he claims it's a marketing term later in the article. But stay tuned. After we dissect Mr. Irving's historical arguments, or lack thereof, in this article, and the ignorance of Mr. Irving in presenting what exactly the pro-life position is, we will look into just what exactly is the pro-life position. What are the arguments for life of the fetus in the womb and the right to the protection of life that the fetus in the womb as a full living human being should have?
Thank you for waking up with Truthspresso. Good morning, and God bless your day.
Hey friends, Daniel Minnick here again. If you liked waking up to this episode of Truthspresso, I would appreciate it if you would rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.